Welcome to the weekend edition of the Price of Business Show. I'm your host, Kevin Price, talking to you about you and your business. And on today's program, we got a lot to cover, as always, and looking forward to introducing you to today's guests. But in addition to that, I do want to mention that the Price of Business, which is one of the longest running business shows in the country, continues 24/7 at priceofbusiness.com. We are adding new content all the time. There you can see all of our regular guests. We have reoccurring guests from Fox Business, from Yahoo Finance, gentlemen like Cody Willard, who was a longtime CNBC and Fox Business anchor. He's on this program every single week. And so we're excited by the talent that we bring you. Also, I do want to mention I've got a book called Making New Rich Books Work for You, and exclusively for our listeners of this program. It's available at a ridiculously low price. If you want to get more information about that, go to priceofbusiness.com. If you read anything by people like Tim Ferriss or Robert Kiyosaki, who's been on my show many, many times, and you know, really were excited but had little to show for it when you try to pursue those things, my book explains why. There's something going on, and the problem really isn't with these authors. It's usually with the reader. And you can get more information about that at priceofbusiness.com. With that, here's our first guest right here on The Price of Business.
Welcome back to the nationally syndicated Price of Business show. I'm your host, Kevin Price, talking to you about you and your business. And one of my favorite people to talk to about the business of healthcare is Brian Gordon. Frankly, I've worked in the insurance industry for years, and he actually has forgotten more about long-term care insurance than I've ever known in the first place. Truly a thought leader in the process, which is why we have had him on the show. Regularly. Brian, always glad to have you on. And real quickly, a little bit about your firm and the one best website to get more information.
Absolutely. So our firm is Gordon Associates Long-Term Care Planning, and we have been in this business for the last 50 years. And what we do is help families, businesses, individuals figure out how to pay for long-term care expenses if they should live long lives and need services in the future. It's all about providing them an income and trying to figure out a way to help mitigate some of those concerns as people get older. And our best website would be bestltcplan.com. That would be bestltcplan.com is the best way to reach us.
Yes, yes. My advice is to not get older, but I haven't found anyone figure out how to navigate that without the obvious alternative. So it's going to happen. You better prepare for it. Brian, great topic today. You know, I remember, again, I sold what you sell, but with the help of people with expertise like you when I was in the industry. And although it was before my time, I remember it being referred to as convalescent home insurance. And that was pretty much it. And it was pretty much standardized and one size fit all. It has changed dramatically, particularly in the last decade.
Absolutely. And then, you know, and even the convalescent care plans, I started in 1990 with my father. In the first couple of years, it was more of the facility plans. But then roughly mid-90s, late 90s, it started to really trigger the home care side of it. And that's really where, you know, where people want to be. If they needed care, they prefer obviously to be in their homes if possible. So it's just kind of changed dramatically in that capacity. And obviously we have more, you know, have choices when it comes to that.
Yeah, and ironically, even though you're often bringing people out to assist, it's really going to be cheaper in the majority of cases per day than being in a facility in many cases.
Yeah, absolutely. It can be. And, you know, there are situations that we've seen where home care then can become start getting more expensive, just depending what our loved one's problems are and how much actual care they might need at home as well. So there's always, it's always a balancing act as they're going through that process.
Yes, and the point here is it's not standardized any longer. It's not one size fits all. So set the stage for us.
Right. So our industry, you know, you have a lot of different choices. About the only thing that's standardized with long-term care insurance is we have what's called the 7702B, and those are federally tax-qualified long-term care insurance plans. anybody that offers a plan within that space, any carrier, whether it's a traditional policy or a hybrid plan, if they're going to function in that long-term care space, has to have that designation on there. And you know, there used to be back in the day, we used to have 120 plus companies to choose from when it came to long-term care insurance policies. And yeah. It's something that you got to dial it down and make it a lot easier. Today, we have a handful of carriers, maybe, two and a half handfuls of carriers to choose from.
Yeah. When I was in the industry, again, relying on professionals like you, I was often asked, why is long-term care insurance more complicated than other types, like home or auto? I heard that all the time. I know why. That's why I brought in experts like you. But I think it's an important answer, a question for you to answer. This is a truism.
Yeah, no, and I think it's hard. It's a hard one to digest. I mean, hey, we all love driving and having cars, and, auto insurance is something that we know we have to have when it comes to that. So long-term care, we're reluctant to look at it because none of us want to envision ourselves in that situation. And as we all know, life does change as we go along. But really, the real difference is that with long-term care insurance, there's a lot of different decision points. There's how much does a person want per day or per month? How long do you want it to run? What type of an elimination period do you want, which is like a deductible? Inflation protection, shared care riders. There's just a lot of different things that you can do with those policies, especially with the standalone plans. With the hybrid plans, certain things, they've made it a lot easier for everybody where you don't have to choose an elimination period. It kind of comes with what it has, and you can't adjust that. So there's just a lot of moving parts and a lot of what ifs when it comes to long-term care insurance and long-term care needs.
Yeah, a lot of variables involved that aren't so much, particularly in the home. I mean, in the auto, but also in the home. It's a different ball of wax. So what are some ways that long-term care insurance and LTC auto and home differ from long-term care? What are some obvious examples?
So, I mean, you have like the elimination period with long-term care is considered a deductible. And then with our auto and homeowners insurance, we could buy anything from a, $500 deductible to, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 deductibles if that's what people wanted to do with the insurance. So that part of it with auto insurance is very definitive on what that dollar amount is out of pocket up front. Whereas long-term care, if I do a 90-day, the elimination period / deductible, it varies because if I only need someone in the home, an hour or two every day is very different than me needing care, 8 to 10 hours or 24/7 when it comes to home care. So with long-term care, it's an unknown somewhat of what that elimination period could look like, and that's part of a whole other conversation that we've talked about before is, elimination period management with long-term care insurance about not starting to use the insurance too late and use it, a little bit at a time at the beginning to meet that 90 or 100. Or I just had a gentleman earlier this year, go through a one-year elimination period that he was well aware of that he did, and he just paid for out of pocket for a year. So that's an area that they have similarities.
Yeah, it makes sense. And again, a lot of that's based on your abilities as well, and support that you already naturally have, those type of factors. Talk a little bit, it's a very important conversation, and again, and really ties into my next question. I was a generalist in the health life area. You're a specialist. What's the difference? I can say again, because I got on the phone, hey, dude, I got a guy who wants my long-term care.
Right. So,
and I had him come along because like you, he ate, drank, and slept. That he knew his stuff, and I'm so glad he did. I feel sorry for people who go to the general insurance agent and they don't, take that same caution that we did. And when I was in the industry, and I've seen horror stories about it not done properly.
Right. No. And I look at like a specialist and really anything you do, it's, I've had, one or two, home claims with floods and I kind of model my business around good customer service, when my clients have questions, when they need to file a claim, you know, that's part of what I should be able to do. When I need, when I have a question about, do I, you know, we hit a curb and we did a little damage to the bottom of our car, is it worth filing a claim? I run that by my auto insurance agent just to make sure that it's not going to affect my premiums down the road and does it make sense? We, you know, it's sort of the same thing when it comes to long-term care. You got to know what you're doing in this industry. And to me, there's a lot of people who are very self-anointed. They call themselves specialists when I have filed more claims than they've ever written policies a lot of times. So to me, a specialist has to be someone that has, you know, at least 5 to 10 years in an industry, and it, it, you know, has to have a reputation, a network, and someone that can not only get you the policy, but can have you help file the claim, help you find caregivers, help you find people to help you find facilities in your area. And that's kind of what a specialist should be in any area, no different than my auto guy, where if something happens, oh, you had a flood, give this guy a call. He can get the water out. Here's a good guy for the construction. It's all about just having good people in your back pocket to really make us look good at the end of the day is really what it's all about. And, you know, anybody can call themselves a specialist, but you got to have some years and some, you know, some history behind that and some, you know, really case studies of dealing with this and that. So I think no matter what we do.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. No question about it. And, yeah, I think, again, I'm always glad I had quality people like yourself. I didn't have you. Unfortunately, I met you after I got out of the industry. Boy, you would have been a phenomenal resource. So, because I can't tell you how many times people did it on their own or did it with the generalist, and they answered the question in the wrong way, which overnight their options were diminished rather quickly.
Right. And I do, you know, and I do work with the, I don't want to call them generalists, but I work with people that, you know, they're big in the health insurance space. They're big in the property and casualty space. And we work together with them, kind of like what you said, is you bring in experts and people who are really good at what they do to make you and I look good. And that's kind of, you know, that's really what, you know, what we're trying to do. And I work with all those type of people to make sure we try to make you look good. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Very good. And believe me, if they're like me, they need all the help they can get. Always love talking to you, Gordon, and Brian Gordon, and always love our chats. They always go so fast. Final thoughts as we wrap it up, and again, go ahead and mention your website.
Absolutely. I think just in anything in life, whatever we're doing, whatever insurance product, investment products, whatever we're doing in life, make sure you're working with the right people. Make sure you ask questions. And if you're skeptical about something and doesn't sound right, you know, trust your instincts and get second opinions out there for yourself. Best website for us is bestlpcplan.com. That's bestlpcplan.com is the best way to reach us.
Yeah, and I encourage people to do that. Thanks so much, Brian. I am Kevin Price. You're listening to the nationally syndicated Price of Business. Stay tuned for more after this.
I'm Kevin Price. You're listening to the nationally syndicated Price of Business show. I'm really excited. We've had Jim Hancock as a regular commentary provider here on the Price of Business show for quite some time. He's incredibly savvy in the technology space, and recently he has begun to join us to do actual interviews on a regular basis about his research and work in the technology space. He's a leading authority in this space. His website, by the way, is JLHancock.com. That's JLHancock.com. He's an author. He's an author of primarily novels, in fact, that deal a lot with issues that relate to technology and national security and a lot of these issues. During his time in the military, Jim worked away at the dark corners of the government intelligence communities. He learned 2 Asian languages and eventually conducted over 100 combat operations with special operations forces in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Philippines. And so he has a fascinating background. Love having him on the program. Love doing this work with him. And again, you can learn more about him at jlhancock.com.
Welcome back to the nationally syndicated Price of Business show. I'm your host, Kevin Price, talking to you about you and your business. Always enjoying my chats with JL Hancock, show regular and a personal favorite on the program.
JL, welcome back to the program. Author extraordinaire, someone who has worked in really the most sensitive areas of military technology, but also has great interest in technology way beyond the military. We always have fun conversations. Good to have you back on, JL. Tell us about your books real quick, and also the best website to get more information about your work.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I write military thrillers based on the work I did when I was the head of innovation for Naval Special Warfare Command, which is the headquarters of the U.S. SEAL teams. And those books are available on Amazon under called the Voodoo series. There's the Hawk Enigma and the Spear and the Sentinel, where I dig into emerging technology as well as applications of artificial intelligence that people aren't really considering. And you can find out more about that at my website, jlhancock.com.
Yeah, very good. Recently, there was a, I feel like I live more and more in like a comic book world, you know, and the good guys are meeting here and the bad guys are meeting here. It's very weird, you know. So you have this event of that took place in China that is being made by, you know, the West is being characterized. And maybe a certain amount of, I think maybe there's a certain amount of truth, you know, a group of rogue nations that got together to talk about cooperation. And before that event or after, I don't know the exact chronology, but Xi and Putin have had a parade. They saw this parade, and it was one heck of a parade. And the thing that impressed observers, journalists, was the technology that was on display in that parade that was of Chinese origin that many seemed surprised they had quite those capabilities. And that's what we're going to focus on today. But before we do, talk about parades in general. I mean, we had one here, and the president berated the Secretary of Defense because of how weak he thought it was. Talk about America and parades versus China and Russia. Man, those guys know how to party.
Yeah, those guys definitely know how to put on a parade. Here's the thing to keep in mind when it comes to formation style marching. That is a remnant of gentleman warfare, and it is left over from the last time we fought in that way was before World War One. We still do military formations for ceremonies and in small numbers, but the thing about being able to put on an event like that is you have to commit a significant amount of time and energy into making the forces able to just even perform in that way. And really, at the end of the day, that's all it is. It's performative. It presents a really good image of what's going on. But if you look really carefully at what the people are walking around carrying, those aren't practical systems. They're props. They're not. It is really just, it is a show. Now, you can sit there and say, why didn't we put on something similar? Well, the reason why we don't put on something similar is because, one, we don't want to dedicate that many of our forces to just learning how to do those formations again, because it's a waste of time. And honestly, there's no tactical or strategic value to training our forces on that. There are instances in which you will have formations when you do ceremonies, but you're not going to be marching in large number. The only time you ever do something like that is when you are at service academies, when you are in initial training like boot camp, and they do that to build unit cohesion. And then once you are done with that unit cohesion and you move on to your commands and you're working on a ship or you're working in a combat unit, you got better things to do than to be marching around goose stepping. So that's one reason why you don't really see it from the United States at all. There's just no value. And so people that understand the military understand that they don't want to wasting our time doing it.
And I'm assuming that I don't want to paint with a broad brush. More authoritarian governments kind of like this, the Chinese, of course, the North Koreans, man, that, I think it's their favorite pastime. Russians are big on this. I think they see value in it, in the appearance, even more than any function.
It does a good job of presenting. I mean, every year North Korea has what they call the Arirang Festival, and right after the Arirang Festival, they do a big march and presentation for the Dear Leader. But those are it's all pomp and circumstance. There's no substance to it. The Chinese one, going back to the technology part, the thing that was interesting is they did have a lot of their gear out on display, which was, you got people need to understand a lot about the thing that Chinese technology that is so significant is the fact that they've done an incredible job of replicating and replacing American technology and then scaling it. And so they don't just have secondhand versions of American tech now. They have a lot of it. And it's getting very sophisticated relative to what the systems they originally stole it from. They're trying to innovate beyond that, and in some categories they're doing a tremendous job, and in other areas they're still lagging behind. But it's the sheer scale and numbers at which they can do it that is the alarming part.
Yeah, and my understanding, I mean, I don't hear much conversation on this, but something that came to my mind is they're not just stealing from the U.S., they're stealing from the West. Right, in general, they're not discriminating. Oh, we don't want to do this to the British or whomever. And as a result, they're not only stealing and reusing and modifying and quote making it their own. They're putting technologies together as they accumulate them.
Yes, and there's another aspect of that that's interesting is the conflict between India and Pakistan was the first time that anyone has used any Chinese-built technology in combat and had it be effective. It was kind of almost their coming out party. It was when the Pakistanis were flying Chinese aircraft and shooting down they shot down a Typhoon, which is a French aircraft, but they ended up, or a Rafale, I think it was one of the two, but they shot down a French aircraft, which was the first time that the Chinese have had a dogfight and one of their aircraft actually operate. Now, the thing that they've got to take that with a grain of salt because you're looking at the relative capabilities of the pilots and where they were flying and why they were flying and all these different things become factors. However, at the end of the day, it was still a Chinese aircraft shooting down a Western one. And that's a big deal for Norco or the other Chinese defense contractors that now are trying to sell to the international community and try to enter the space that has predominantly been dominated by the U.S. and Russia.
Yeah. And they really work. That's what it says on your brochures.
Yeah.
Yeah, so talk a little bit, it's funny you bring this up, because in so many ways, and really the problem has been for Russia in dealing with Ukraine, which frankly the entire world, and especially Russia, was shocked by their difficulties that they've had dealing with Ukraine, was these very same technological problems. And it wasn't so much that they lack the technology, they lack the supplies, but I've always wondered, they didn't do very well in the procurement process, and it got wasted with corrupt military leaders who were profiting off of it, from what we can tell. But I was wondering about that with China. We see this very impressive, lots of materiel, how significant of a power is it in reality? And your track record is the example you gave. This is your coming out party. They've been around for a little while, Dale. I think a lot of people scratch their head and wonder what they're dealing with when they're dealing with China.
Yeah. So the resourcing element is the biggest value that China brings to really anybody, is because they are controlling almost 95% of the world's precious metals. They are a manufacturing giant. The thing that's also significant about the Chinese manufacturing side is they have what they refer to as innovation factories, where they'll come up with an idea. Somebody will just come up with an idea, and like 50, 60 different groups will just start trying to mass manufacture it, all being subsidized by the government. And they will basically weed each other out to determine who actually has the chops to make the effective capability. And by the time they're done, there's three or four companies that are able to mass produce these things in a really short period of time. And it's at a scale that is very different than the way that we do things in the United States, because we tend to default to regulate and then innovate. And they are moving the model of innovate then regulate, which is the way that we used to do things. But as time's gone by, we've implemented more policy limitations. We've started increasing overhead costs. It's just limited. It's not just cost and resource prohibitive, but we've kind of tied our hands behind our back when it comes to this. And the Chinese have loosened the reins and allowed themselves to expand. And Russia is trying to take advantage of that. The hard part, though, is the Russian economy isn't doing so well. And they can only be selling themselves out for so long before they implode on themselves. And so it's an interesting trifecta between North Korea, Russia, and China, whereas China's basically going to be at the point where everyone is going to have to follow their lead, because they have all the resources Russia wants to be the authoritarian that can grow and expand, but they really don't have the leverage they once did, and they haven't proven their military to be nearly as competent as we once thought they were. It is interesting to see how they are trying to, and it's also interesting to watch how they have collapsed in the face of small-scale Western decentralized operations. The difference being the U.S. uses an NCO corps, and we delegate to the lowest level when it comes to how we operate in the battlefield. The Russians and the Chinese still maintain a more Soviet style of it's top down. And when you lose an officer, there's no way of fighting because nobody understands what they need to do. Whereas the Ukrainians, as slow as they were adopting a Western style, and it allowed them to more unconventionally respond to the conventional force.
Yeah, and by the way, you hit on one of the biggest problems Russia had, particularly the first year and a half of the war, of the death of generals. You know, generals were being forced to be in positions where they're going to get shot because these Russian soldiers couldn't do it on their own.
Right. And that's an interesting thing. So, like, you can do a decapitation strike against a force like that and take out a lead officer of that scale, and they're crippled. You do that to the United States military, we just flex, and it wouldn't impact us.
Yeah.
It would hurt. We don't, not to say that we're okay with it, but the lowest NCO is just as important as the highest general in many cases. And that's the value of our force. And it's a hard thing. And that really is something that's the difference between a volunteer military and a conscripted military, because the value of the individuals is significantly higher, which is also the reason why we don't make our guys goose step for long periods of time, because we value their time, hopefully.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's interesting. Yeah, your description of on a strategic level and the differences between us and them really reminds me, echoes back of the Revolutionary War, and one of the ways that the U.S. won and the British could not is they were using old European, the British were using old European style, here we are, ready to fight, wearing the clothes that made it so easy to be found, whereas the U.S. really were essentially a guerrilla force.
Yeah, the unconventional warfare element has historically been the most effective way of usurping and operating an insurgency against these larger military forces. However, it's at scale, you still have to be able to bring large numbers to bear, and that is going to be the aspect of. But the other thing that has changed a lot with modern warfare is that the range at which you can operate, and the distance that you're able to place sensors forward to detect the enemy's movement and to respond or to proactively engage, it has changed dramatically. And that's where those new technologies are going to be critical for all the forces, is because we don't want to be in trenches fighting at close range. And if you're looking at areas like the Indo-Pacific region of the theater of the world, it's all over the water. So it really is about how you can operate at a distance. And so there's going to be a lot of changes coming to the way that we look at war. And we're just praying that we don't try to engage in these particular things. We use the other elements of dime, you know, diplomacy and military and the economic processes that allow us to actually have a better effect in the battle and in the international arena, rather.
Yes. JL, we got to wrap it up with that. I see we're going a little over, which is fine because it's such important information. Your website one more time, and again, a little more about what you do, your books. Mention that again.
Sure. JLHancock.com, and I write thrillers based on the work I did developing new technology for the warfighter.
Thank you very much. Love your work. Love our conversations. I'm Kevin Price. This is the nationally syndicated Price of Business show. Stay tuned for more after this.
Are you leading with clarity or simply reacting? Hi, I'm Daphne Michaels, human potential expert and ultra consciousness leadership guide. Welcome to my series, The Next Level, on the Price of Business Digital Network. In the fast-paced world of leadership and business, it's easy to fall into the trap of reacting to challenges rather than proactively shaping your path. And just trying not to react is nearly impossible without understanding a very important concept. I want to introduce you to the transformative mechanism in the human psyche, our witness. Our witness is a higher level aspect of our psyche, an impartial observer that operates in a broader bandwidth of awareness. It doesn't judge. It doesn't rush. It simply observes. By developing your witness, you gain the ability to step back and see the full landscape of your leadership and decisions. You'll recognize how you're showing up in your role and how others are responding to you. This clarity is essential for avoiding confusion and staying grounded in the complexities of business and leadership. Every leader needs to develop their witness. It's the key to navigating challenges with insight and composure. If you're ready to elevate your leadership and decision-making, I invite you to visit my website at daphnemichaels.com and begin developing this powerful part of your psyche today.
Welcome back to the nationally syndicated Price of Business show. I'm your host, Kevin Price, talking to you about you and your business. And let's face it, what's going on in the larger culture, what's going on in the world of politics, all of this is part of our business. And you know, this show is almost a quarter of a century old. It's hard to believe that. 25th anniversary next year. And, you know, after this many years, I take a lot of liberties about what we discuss, and I love to discuss this issue, and I particularly enjoy talking with David Wilcox about it. He is, by the way, his website is the flimflamchronicles.com. I love that name, the flimflamchronicles.com, and by the way, we'll have a link to that over at priceofbusiness.com, of course. And he's got a fascinating background. He was a former bodyguard to Pat Robertson, who ran for president, sat on the front row of some of the biggest things that were going on, particularly in the most political era of Pat Robertson's life. And always enjoy talking to you, David, picking your brain and talking about these things.
Well, Kevin, it's always an honor and privilege to talk to you, but picking my brain is going to be rather a diet. There's not much to pick at.
you're too modest. Okay, and I want you to talk about your writings, you know, mention those.
Well, I wrote two books. One is called Protecting Pat Robertson: Confessions of a High-Priced Bagman, and the other is about a man I consider to be the most duplicitous beast on the planet, Ralph Reed, who is Pat's choice to head up his political arm called the Christian Coalition. And that is called The Trial of the Devil Incarnate, Ralph Reed, God's Flimflam Man. And they're both available on Amazon. But I was at the front row, as you mentioned, of a lot of Pat Robertson's goings on, his meetings, whenever he was meeting with anybody or planning anything, I was by his side. So there was a lot of information. I think both books are in the 400-plus page range.
Yeah, and people, I encourage people to check them out. These are two people I knew. In fact, knew Ralph Reed really well. You know, he was right next to his office, was right next door to mine when he was with College Republicans. We would see each other at least a couple of times every week, and we were all talking very similar. You know, that place is almost like a fraternity up there, as you can imagine, the Heritage Foundation building. And you weren't in there unless you were kind of in that camp. And he and I, you know, talked fairly regularly. His reputation then was one of the most, honestly, snake-like people on the right. And that was among people on the right. So we were like, we don't trust him. We don't believe him. That was his reputation then. In some ways, it even got worse after his Damascus Road experience, which is kind of how he describes his conversion. And so, yeah, it's very, very, that's an interesting story. We've talked about him before. I got a feeling we will at some point talk about him again. But we're going back. We're going to go back to his Pat Robertson's presidential campaign. And I ran into him quite often because of the work I was doing. Never worked with him or for him. But Pat Robertson hits the fundraising panic button, as you eloquently put it. Set the stage for us, David.
Well, you know, Pat Robertson ran for president in 1988, and he made a decision to violate the law and give his campaign a donor list from CBN, his ministry. And after the Michigan primary and Super Tuesday, it was painfully obvious he was not going to be the nominee for the Republican Party. So he came back to CBN and found the place had been decimated. 600-plus people lost their job as a result of Pat's decision to run for president. Donations dropped off like a rock. So Pat panicked. He realized one day, he said, gee, if the ministry took such a hit when I was gone for a couple of months on the campaign trail, what in the heck is it going to do when I go to and stand in front of the pearly gates? And he wanted to see this thing that he had built up from a $7 investment into a multi-million dollar worldwide ministry. So he started looking around for what I call get-rich-quick schemes and things that were really outside his purview normally. And I've got three examples of this to share today. They're fairly brief. I'm going to keep the details limited for time, but they can all be found in the book about Pat Robertson. But Pat fancied himself quite the astute businessman. After all, he built CBN on a $7 startup. But he had one Achilles heel. He rarely performed due diligence on his pending investments. His motto that I attached to him was ready, fire, aim. And he had three in his first, I guess, business debacle that I wanted to talk about was a company called Senco, C-E-N-C-O, Refining Inc. That was the name Pat gave it this business venture. In the late 90s, he planned to take over the crude oil market in California. Why a televangelist would want to do that, I don't know. But California was experiencing a gas crisis at the time, so Pat bought an abandoned 62-year-old oil refinery plant named Powerine, and it was located in a town called Santa Fe Springs near Huntington Beach, near the coast. Powerine ceased all operations in 1995, and so Pat, when he took it over, gave it the new name of Senco. And the concept of this investment was simple. Senco would offload crude oil from tankers that were offshore off the coast of California near Huntington Beach, pipe it in directly to their Senco facility, and then refine it. It would be processed, I guess, the best word would be in this state-of-the-art and advanced technology refinery. But Pat failed to do his due diligence, as I mentioned, in discovering the history of the Powerine company and equated refinery infrastructure. And it was all accessible. And what he would have found was the Powerine operated under massive environmental violations. They were one of the biggest polluters in the area. And in fact, a lot of the people that lived in the area constantly complained of ill effects on their skin and lungs from the pollution that Powerine was pumping out. They even had, it was even bad enough to destroy paint jobs on cars that were in the area. And the problems ran so rampant in Pat's $20 million investment with trying to get this company, this refinery up to snuff, that he ended up spending over $75 million and not a single drop of oil was processed. And it all would have been, he could have bypassed all of it if he had just done some due diligence and checked out their reputation.
Yeah, and by the way, we have 10 minutes total. So although that was relatively short, you do three of those, and I always have questions, we're going to be a little challenged. So just keep that in mind.
I've got two more shorter ones. Uh-huh. His next debacle came in an attempt to control the internet in China, believe it or not. this is Pat and Christian broadcaster Pat kind of conflicted. The Christian Coalition was scooping in millions of dollars in support for their stance against China human rights record, and this included their one-child policy. Pat, when he was under the Christian Coalition, protested it, felt it was a form of abortion. But this deal came along, and Pat needed to curry favor with the Chinese government for it to go through. So he did a complete flip-flop, and he started promoting or supporting China's right for the one-child, I'm sorry, I can't say that, their one-child policy. Pat came out in favor of it. So it turned out that the one of the reasons he did this was the Family Channel cable network that he owned had already invested $10 million to acquire a cable outlet in China, and Pat announced his support for the Chinese one-child policy because he needed the favor of the government. So he spent $3 on that, and it was going to be called, pardon my pronunciation, Zhao Dala, which was translates roughly into I've found it. It took a hit on 9/11, which would be today, and that terrorist attack caused the international investment efforts and money to dry up and the investment to take over the internet in China is simply evaporated.
Well, how naive. That is so naive. And by the way, it isn't just an abortion policy. The one child was infanticide, the killing of born children. So, I mean, it's so beyond the realm. It's unbelievable. This is what money does to people. Very little time left. The last one, please.
The trifecta of failed business ventures found Pat trying to open up a Christian-based theme park to be located near the Sea of Galilee. Things were going along swimmingly, but Pat put his foot in his mouth on the 700 Club broadcast on January 5th when he did his commentary segment, and he made a statement to the effect that Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's recent massive stroke had been a matter of divine retribution and for dividing God's land for Israel and conceding the Gaza Strip to the Palestinian Authority. So Israel pulled their partnership out of the deal, and that one too blew up. There's no estimate on what that one cost him, but overall, just these three examples cost Pat and the CBN coffers hundreds, if not millions, of dollars just due to his lack of due diligence and impulsive shoot from the hip attitude.
Yeah, well, let's say millions, if not hundreds of millions. Yeah, let's put it that way. Yeah, incredible stories. None of which got much exposure, to be honest with you. These kind of quietly happened. Frankly, he should have been out of business just on the China deal. He should have seen his support disappear just on the China deal alone, just because of the, we're talking infanticide here. It was so coercion-based. Even extreme liberals don't support the way it was being implemented, forcing people to have these abortions. It's incredible. Final thoughts on this and some takeaways, David?
Well, I'd caution people to be careful of donating to some of these organizations that are what I would consider radical, either the leftists or the ultra-conservatives. There's always a lot of money involved, and money and politics corrupt things, so I would just be very guarded. Sometimes the people are not always what they seem, especially on television. And just be cautious. I mean, nobody's perfect, but some of these things are well outside the comfort zone for most believers and supporters of ministries. And it just simply baffled me why Pat would get involved in something like that. I used to tell him quite often, Pat, there's an old saying, you dance with the one that brought you to the dance, and you didn't get where you are now by business ventures outside of the ministry. You got here because of the ministry. And I really feel in my heart, Kevin, that God saw Pat going into politics and decided to pull his blessing off of Pat. And Pat's blessing always came through money to the ministry. So I'm not Nostradamus. I don't have a clairvoyance bone in my body, but that's what I sure feel happened when he gave up the donor list.
Yeah. And I really do fundamentally believe that bad decisions are more motivated by fear than evil.
And clearly that sounds like the case here. Evil look, fear can really look evil. And when you're making deals with devils like China, obviously you're operating a lot out of fear. So, and I think he was blindsided by the fact that I think he thought he had some kind of hedge of protection that was unique for him, that he could do these things, even though the rest of us could not. And so there's a certain amount of hubris in all this, pride, if you will. I think.
Well, Pat was absolute monarch, dictator at CBN. There was no one in that entire organization that had the cojones to walk up to him and say, hey, I think you're doing wrong. I think you're in an area you shouldn't be in. And he went off like a wild dog. And nobody ever pulled the reins in. There was nobody to rein on him. His board of directors were a bunch of puppets. His wife, car dealer, it was like open season for him to spend money and chase his dreams.
Got to end with that. And always enjoy our chats. That's David Wilcox, author and great commentator as well. And give your website one more time.
It's called theflimflamchronicles.com. It's got some audio narratives about Ralph Reed and Pat Robertson. There's no charge on it. It gives some good enlightening background in the history of both those gentlemen.
Very good. All right, we're going to wrap up with that. I want to remind you that we have neither tried nor convicted either of these people. These are our opinions based on our own personal observations. Since we live in a really quick-to-sue culture, I always like to throw that in. Thanks so much, David. I appreciate it. I am Kevin Price. This is the nationally syndicated Price of Business. Stay tuned for more after this. Welcome back to the nationally syndicated Price of Business show. I'm your host, Kevin Price, talking to you about you and your business. I love talking to global correspondent, or contributor rather, Gitti Mavenlaer. She's from Europe. She gives us a very interesting global perspective on a lot of the same issues we're talking about, and she gets beyond just the raw politics and policy. It really takes a deep dive into the systemic issues that are driving so many of the problems that we have today. I find it a fascinating series. We've got feedback from people who think it's such an interesting take and wonder why there isn't more like this out there. And Gitti, always love having you on the program. Real quickly, kind of give us an overview of your firm and the best website to get more information.
Thank you, Kevin, for having me. Yes, what I'm doing is really I'm an expert in energetic leadership. I help businesses and individuals defining and aligning and allowing their organizations and also their physical bodies to be in a receiving mode so they are in sync with who they are and what they want. So what we do is that we work with strategic foresight, energy consciousness, and business transformation in one. So energetic leadership is change management for the new era, I would say. And you can find my book, Energetic Leadership, where there's a free workbook and other services like keynotes and workshops and mentorship at energeticleadership.eu.
Yeah, people should check that out. And we, as always, will have a link to that at priceofbusiness.com. Really interesting topic today, which, we're going to talk about how to stop hate with your energetic command of love. I love this. And it's kind of, if people look at it on the surface, oh, that's very touchy-feely. What a nice thought. But the reality is that what I'm seeing is many of the things that we focus on as countries and even as people, such as public policy or laws, they're not working. They're really not. That doesn't mean you don't continue to work that front, but we need to stop being naive and pretending those are the only fronts and really look at some of the things you're talking about that are systemic.
Yes, very much so. So I see when I look at it, I see it not just happening in the U.S. I see you know, demonstrations taking place both in the UK, in Nepal, in Indonesia, in the Middle East. We have lots of issues and in France and whatever. So there's something about the way that we have got both the political power and also the commercial power a bit mixed up, maybe. So maybe that's what we are seeing people reacting to. And then on top of that, we have all our media and SoMe, I think especially SoMe, social media, that we are able to see everything in an instant. That is really causing, I think, sometimes it's of course very nice to have instant knowledge of something, but on the other hand, it can also be really challenging, especially if you are not able to control your own use of that kind of intake.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, and also there just doesn't seem to be a whole lot of cognitive thinking about things. It's more reactionary. Oh, this happened, I got to do this. That happened, yeah. I have to do that. And that creates a lot of the violence that's taking place, the overreacting, the lack of empathy. You know, I think about, you mentioned social media. So many people, literally, they either are only engaging with people that provide an echo chamber for them, and or they're going after people to attack because they disagree with them. And that's pretty much the extent. There's very little real conversation going on today. And, you know, in my country, I think, you know, we have a president who pretty much loathes the idea of real engagement because that threatens his position of always being right. You know, if your premise is, I'm always right, you're not going to want to have meaningful, empathetic dialogue. You're simply not going to do that.
No.
And I think we see that a lot in this president. But as you pointed out, you know, the problem is not a U.S. problem. It really is a global problem. And I see a lot of talk about the symptoms, really not a whole lot of even treatment of the symptoms, but a whole lot of talk about it. And I hear virtually no conversation about the systemic issues. And I think social media is a huge part of it. It is very easy to create your own echo with social media. And then you think the number of news sites and news sources that exist now compared to even a decade ago, let alone 20 years ago, it is very easy to create your own world that if others don't accommodate, you might as well just forget it. And that's not how you keep a peaceful society or a peaceful planet.
No, and that's why you could say that when we look at all the issues, and they're really worldwide, more with this, some differences in impact. But how do a human being go about being in this kind of society then? And if you only look at or listen to SoMe or go to the internet or the dark web or whatever, then it's very, very, you become very, I would say, single-minded. So my emphasis is really very much on how do we get back to some of our, you could say, old traditions of having a physical dialogue, just being able to talk to each other. You know, it could be not just in a political arena, but just talking to a human being in your neighborhood or your family. We actually see that people have difficulties in having these normal dialogues because we're so used to just reacting by writing something or reacting. So that is really one way of going about having another action to what is happening, then maybe go and talk to someone about it, and also getting out of that loneliness that SoMe can create if you are feeling that, you know, your only friend is SoMe or it may be ChatGPT, then it also, I'm concerned about it becoming an echo chamber of an unbalanced relationship.
Yeah, no question about it. So get it. Let's get into the, with the time we have left. Let's get into this into a little more depth. You know, where do you, you know, what I hear from you, Gethe, is that you don't begin with the macro, you begin with the micro, and the micro is the individual. That's what I'm getting from what you're saying.
Yes. Yes, it's really that, you know, we as an individual, where is our power? Maybe we look outside, but really the power is within us. So if we are walking around and think that, the world or the other person is the problem, really it's maybe me who has some kind of, I call it wound, that I have to address. And the way that I should address it is by not being with myself, but at least talk to someone else. Because if we feel alone with some kind of wound inside, it could be any, you know, coming from lots of different things, feeling awkward or not being loved or lost my boyfriend or whatever, then we can get traumatized or we can get disengaged or we can even get depressed or whatever, and maybe that will lead to other, you know, stupid actions, getting into drugs, doing stupid things, whatever. Stupid in the sense that it's not good for us, but it's a reaction to that we are not feeling seen, heard, or understood.
So with the last couple of minutes left, kind of give us a practical kind of step-by-step how to get out of the mode we might be in and get into a more healthy place as we wrap it up.
Well, one step could be just to put down the phone. If you are in an environment where, of course, it's not that you have to dial 111 because you need a doctor, because then you should use your phone. But if you really need to calm your system, put down the phone and also go away from the computer. Maybe take a walk into nature. Go out with bare feet if it's not cold and walk on the grass. That's one thing. Another thing could be just to close your eyes and breathe just for 10 minutes. Try and breathe and just be in that moment. A third thing could be go to a relative or a friend or acquaintance or talk to someone. A fourth thing could be to smile when you just walk out the door and smile a second time when you walk down the street. So it's those little simple things that can change your energy. So if you feel a little bit down, you know, what is it that I can do? Instead of going down, you can go up. And in that sort of crossing, you have a choice.
Makes perfect sense. Give your website one more time where people can get more information.
My website is www.energeticleadership.eu.
Make sure you check that out. We, of course, will have a link over at priceofbusiness.com. And, I, you know, to me, it reminds me a lot of what Gandhi said, which, you know, if you want change, be the change. And I think a lot of us want to have a profound, powerful impact on a macro level, but we can't even begin to get into that place until we take care of ourselves individually and be responsible for ourselves individually. And that's so hard to do. Thank you so much, as always.
Thank you. You're welcome. And we have so much power, each of us.
Yeah, we do. Absolutely.
We do.
I am Kevin Price. You're listening to the nationally syndicated Price of Business Show. Stay tuned for more after this.
That wraps up another Price of Business. I am glad to be with you. Really enjoyed it and enjoying our new home here on these stations around the country. I do want to remind you that the show continues 24/7. Not only do we have this weekly show that you can hear on this station, but we're on other stations around the country with a daily program as well. You can easily learn about them by visiting us at priceofbusiness.com. We affectionately say it is the show that never ends, and what we mean by that is that it continues 24/7 with the addition of new audio, video, articles, and more at priceofbusiness.com. While there, we'd like you to engage with us on social media. Follow us on Facebook and, like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Kevin Price Live and all of our sister sites as well. All right, I'm going to take a break until next time. Next week, we'll be back with you with much more information for you. And look forward to that conversation. And I want to say, again, thank you to USA Business Radio to make it possible for this to have been commercial-free, an entire hour of commercial-free. And guess what? Even more commercial-free than public radio. So we're excited about that. Enjoy the rest of your day right here on this station.